Hi, and welcome to Song Divers, an interview podcast about singer-songwriters.
We like to go deep in conversation with our favorite musicians in search of honest answers.
What are the ingredients of a great song?
What makes a songwriter tick?
Can a musician make a living these days?
Is Jason Isbell overrated?
What?
My name is Stefan.
And this is Ed. This episode, we welcome a seasoned singer-songwriter who strikes the perfect balance between grit and tenderness.
Hey folks, my name is Joshua O'Reilly.
Seven shot revolver on my side, loaded with lust and greed and pride, loaded with envy and anger too. So I wouldn't have to work to have more than you, and I wouldn't have to work if I wanted yours too.
This Illinois-born musician's tunes shed an intelligent light on topics ranging from blue-collar struggles to some of the more unique corners of life, all through a lens that feels both refreshing and familiar.
Despite a bushy but controlled white beard and a totally shaved head, Josh has a youthfulness about him. He's friendly, sincere, and relatable. There's a balance to him, too. He's excited by his craft and music, humble, but also exudes a kind of relaxed wisdom, the kind that comes from experience and necessity rather than intentional study.
Yes, and every day I do my part to put another bullet in the sacred heart.
I met Josh for the first time at the first open mic night I ever did by myself. His beard was darker then, and he was yet to write some of the best songs you'll ever hear. Years later, I would cross paths with Josh again and help produce his record. Riley's first studio release, Mercy on the Strange, hit shelves in 2017 to rave reviews, and it landed him a spot at the coveted Dripping Springs Songwriters Festival outside of Austin, Texas. We hope you enjoy hearing about Josh's story and his songs. Where are you from?
I'm originally from Springfield, Illinois.
How long did you live in Illinois?
Spent 27 years there.
So you just moved?
Yeah. No, we've been down here going on 11 now.
Okay. Yeah. And were you always in Illinois?
Yeah, and up until we moved to Florida. Yep.
So I obviously know you a little bit. A lot of it, I would say.
Yeah.
Actually, one of the songs that you were playing the other day, there was somebody else there that knew you. She mentioned that like the song came, or like somebody that was referencing the song came from like time living on a Christmas tree farm.
Oh, I did spend some time living on a Christmas tree farm. And yeah, there definitely were some songs that came out of that space, because there was some close friends of mine that were also musicians that lived there. So we were doing a bit of writing it back then.
And how old were you when you were doing that?
Mid-20s. Yeah. Mid to late 20s.
And then I feel like you told me that you spent some time in Texas too, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, only a recent trip for a songwriting festival I was involved with, the Dripping Springs Songwriter Festival. And I went down there when I was like 21. It was the first time before then.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking of. I feel like in the times you've been doing some writing and I've been around to watch some of the songs come together, that you told me about, I wish I could remember the guy's name, but somebody who was a Texas based songwriter that was really, really great, but like never hit it, but a bunch of people knew him. Am I just making this up?
No, I don't think so. I don't know. When I went down there the first time, my friend Jason Eklund was recording an album with Gurf Morlicks.
Oh yeah. Gurf.
Yeah. So I rode down there with my good friend Tom Irwin, and he was to play some bass on this album. So I thought, well, I need to see what Austin's like. So
was Gurf producing?
Gurf was producing, engineering. It was all done in his home studio, which I believe a lot of Lucinda's early stuff came out of that same room. I got to go one day while we were there. And the rest of the time I was with Roger, the homeless fiddle player from New Orleans.
Oh, Roger the homeless fiddle player.
Everybody listening knows Roger.
Yeah. I mean, we've all seen this guy. So he was a guest of Jason's that was up there while he was recording this. And I don't know what purpose he served to the recording project, but he was there basically. Him and I, we'd hung out during the day.
Was he doing any fiddle play?
Well, see, he was a street performer in New Orleans, so he would, we'd go out in the morning when these guys go to the studio, we'd go to downtown Austin and on Guadalupe, and he'd pull out his fiddle in the morning and play it just long enough to where he had like $3 or $5 to get a little bottle of vodka, and he'd pour it into...
I was going to guess ham and eggs, but...
No. This was his entire diet, I think, so. So he'd pour vodka into that, and then when that was gone, he'd pull the fiddle out again and get another $3 or $5 and go into the liquor store.
That is industrious.
I think we all know that route to fame.
Right. I don't think he quite got to fame, but he did have some good songs.
So did you play on that at all?
I did not play on it at all. Nope. I was only in the studio the one day as a guest, just kind of checking it out and looking out over the lake behind Gerf's house. It was a pretty cool experience.
So let's go back to, because we're getting ahead of ourselves. Mm-hmm. We need to establish a base. So what was your upbringing like? What was your family like? What were your parents like? Like, is that where your music came from?
There was guitars around when I was a kid, just for a short time, just floating around the house, and we'd mess with them a little bit. My mom used to play a little bit. One day, my dad went to the flea market and they sold all of them, and so we didn't have any guitars.
That's the opposite, yeah.
Yeah, but then it all comes back around when I got grounded for drinking.
At 14.
Somewhere around there, and then I borrowed an uncle from my guitar, and then it was all over from that.
Did you say borrowed?
I borrowed a guitar from my uncle, both, Mark.
Both very industrious still.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that was it.
So you're stuck in your room playing?
Yeah, just, I figured it was a good way to pass the time. Like, I spent time learning how to play Neil Young songs by ear, and it went from there.
So was your dad musical?
Nope. Nope, he loves music and he loves good songwriters. But the only song I've ever heard him sing is "Out in the West Texas Town of El Paso," and it was only maybe the first couple of lines.
Uh-huh. Until he passed out.
No, he was just wandering through the living room one day, and I heard him do it.
What about Uncle Mark?
I never heard him do anything. Some of my mom's brothers were in bands and singers, so that there was music in the family. Everybody likes to sing, so.
And so, were they playing a lot of music? Like, what did your parents listen to?
They listened to a lot of like John Prine. Wow. And a lot of my mom liked Harry Nilsson a lot, so we listened to him a lot, and Harry Chapin.
Okay,
which he's. He's an interesting songwriter in his own right. He's written some really...
All the Cats in the Cradle and the Sioux.
Mm-hmm. The most famous one there. He goes out there on a limb sometimes, too, though. He's got some strange songs, which is cool.
So what kind of kid were you? It sounds like you were grounded at least this one time. Were you a good kid or a bad kid? Were you into sports?
I was definitely not into sports. Horrible at sports. I was on three teams of three different sports at three different times in my early childhood, and not at any time did I have any idea what I was supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
I was just standing there like, don't give me the ball. Don't give me the ball.
That sounds like bad coaching.
Yeah, or just, yeah, obliviousness.
It wasn't your fault.
Yeah. Let's blame it on them.
In case no one's ever told you before, Josh, it's not your fault.
Quit beating yourself up about that.
Yeah, so, no, sports was never a thing. I mean, yeah, I liked to watch sports and... but only to a certain degree.
So you're sitting in your room, you listen to Neil Young trying to figure out the guitar because you have nothing else to do.
Right.
One can only play with themselves for so long.
Yeah.
When did you start writing? Like, when did it occur to you, like, I'm gonna write my own song?
I started writing songs probably when I was around 16 years old or so. Starting writing songs and parodies to songs and whatever stuff to make my friends laugh and instrumental thing, so just the creative bone kind of hit around then.
Were you a kid sitting around thinking about what you wanted to be doing, like Visions of Grandeur on stage, or?
Yeah, not really. Just at that point, I think I just wanted to come up with something that my friend could play some lead guitar on, and we just would jam. You know, that was it. That was it. I hadn't really thought that far ahead. So as far as seeing myself on a big marquee somewhere or anything, but
or you know, Dripping Springs Songwriters Music Festival,
right?
How about a band? Did you ever go to bass and drums and?
Yeah, full, when we were in high school, we had nothing that was super serious, but we had we had drums, we had bass and everything in the jam room, and then I was in some bands early on, but actually the first band that was like semi serious was a band called Winebox, and that was in Springfield, Illinois, with my friend Jordan Lair, who's going to be playing with me at Wigfest coming up here. He's been doing some Florida dates with me now that he's living in Cape Coral.
Is he the pedal steel player?
Yes, the pedal steel player. And then
I've seen him. He's excellent.
Yeah, he's a good guy. And then my friend Matt Miner, who's going to pass away, but he was, him and I both had acoustic guitars, and Jordan played, went back and forth between the pedal steel and upright bass.
Did you guys last a while?
No, it was a short-lived experience, maybe a year and a half, 2 years.
And were you like, you were gigging out?
We didn't have to really look for gigs too much because my brother was running a club called the Underground City Tavern, and it was the best place to play because it was a perfect stop between bands coming from St. Louis to Chicago or vice versa, and he'd pick up awesome bands a lot, so we get to open for people there and see a lot of great acts. So that was as far as we needed to go.
So nepotism is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, yeah. Take advantage of anything you can.
Absolutely,
you know?
It's who you know.
Yeah,
who you were raised with, I guess, in this case.
Nope.
So what else did you do for work? Were you just gigging the whole time, or did you have jobs growing up?
I have always had jobs. That's when you're in the Midwest, you've got like. I mean, I had, I don't know, three or four jobs at one point at the same time. Just work all the time is what I was doing. So
were any of them miserable jobs?
Not super miserable, but I mean...
Were they mostly corn related?
Yeah, so. I think it would tie into everything.
Corn and snow?
Yeah. I could tie corn into every job I ever had, probably. My first job, movie theater, popping popcorn.
Popcorn.
See?
Fresh.
And then I worked at the butcher shop, you know, the meat plant there in town.
Pigs, hogs,
yeah, pigs, hogs. Yep. They're corn fed.
Mm-hmm.
Deer. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You'll find corn in there.
You find corn mostly anywhere.
Yeah.
So what brought you to Florida? What got you out of Illinois and down here?
Just you know, when I got married, Shay's. Disdain for cold weather had finally sunk in, and we were like, all right, let's go try something new. Mm-hmm. And so we loaded up and headed down here, and yeah, it's ended up to be a really good move.
We should mention too that Shay is here photographing the session. She's a talented photographer. So if you hear someone yell BS loudly from the background at anything Josh says, that's likely her.
She's the BS meter on Josh here tonight. Yeah. So.
So, okay, so you get down to Florida, and then are you, like, you're still writing songs? Are you pursuing it?
I hadn't been writing towards the end of my time in Illinois, and then when we got here, I was, you know, doing a lot of cover gigs and stuff like that. So it got to the point where I was so busy doing that I wasn't playing guitar for anything else. I wasn't playing guitar at home. I didn't want to learn a new song. I didn't want to write a new song. I was just like, I'm not playing because I just did 2 4-hour gigs yesterday. So it paid, you know, well enough for a long time. And then it just got to be where music was a chore, and that's not what I wanted it to
See, be. That's an interesting thing. I've had a few people ask me recently as we're launching this podcast, you know, like, oh man, like you're talking to these songwriters. Is it, you're like, you're, you know, you're still playing out. Do you want to go on tour? Like, is that what you want to do? And sometimes my answer is I don't know, because until you really hit it, you know, I mean, could be a pretty miserable existence, you know?
Yeah.
But it's the same idea. Like, it's your chore. It's your living. You're not doing it for passion. You're driving and you're moving stuff and to play for an hour, maybe 2 hours, maybe 3 if you're doing a long set somewhere or you're on the road. But yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's a serious occupational hazard of music, I think, is burnout and not enjoying this thing that you were really passionate about.
Well, and these are cover gigs you're talking about, though.
Yeah, when I was first here, yeah, that's what I was doing a lot of. And
so those can be soul suckers.
Yes.
Especially, they can be soul suckers.
Especially yeah. if it's 4 hours. And
4 hours, and maybe you've got like a football game over your left shoulder, and yeah.
How did you move from the grind of trying to make money as a cover artist into getting back into writing?
The way that went down was, 2015, I said, all right, that's it. I'm going to get like a job, and I'm not going to play these 3 and 4 hour gigs. I'm going to do one a month. I kept one gig a month, 3 hour gig at a place that the family all like to go and hang, and kept that and thought, this is it. I'm going to start writing songs, and because I have all this extra time, and the only time I'm going to play is when it's just me. And then I didn't write any songs, and so but it was nice. It was a nice just step back out of that scene and do something else for a while. And then as 2016 came around, I'm looking at my date book and I'm trying to think of something great, you know, to do. And I was starting a new job at a brewery called Crooked Thumb Brewery, and they were set to open the doors January 1st of 2016, as you know, 7 days a week. And so I started a songwriting group that was going to meet every other Tuesday at that point. And I was going to set out a theme, and we were going to write a song on it. And I hadn't written a song in 10 years.
So did the Tuesday night group at Crooked Thumb, did that actually kind of kickstart your writing?
Or oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. It was a really, really like right off the bat kind of deal where songs were coming out, and I was just, you know, I forced myself to tap into that creative side of things, and it stuck around for long enough to have enough songs to do a full length
album. It's kind of a useful technique. For a while, I worked with a group that would pitch music for commercials and TV shows and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so there was always that prompt, like it's a mortgage commercial. So they want, you know, they want a song that's not talking about them, but they want a song that's talking about home.
Right.
So I ended up with all this stuff and wouldn't get picked up, but I'd have a snippet of a song.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's, you know, you're writing, oh, I got to write something really catchy and, you know, with a hook, and you know, so it was a useful way to kind of jumpstart your writing. So it's similar to what you're talking about. Like you have a mechanism in place that's actually helping you write material.
Yep. And the cool thing about, you know, putting it out there and actually having people show up is just to see, you know, the different places that people take these themes, and it's been really rewarding and interesting.
So whose idea was it to do that?
I mean, I looked up, you know, what songwriters do to get together with other people, and kind of, you know, based it off of a couple different things. So I thought that we would just, you know, put it out there, and, you know, it seemed like a good platform and nice social media and everything where we could reach a lot of people. And
so you just pitched it to the owners?
Just pitched it to the owners before we even opened, and Kip, Kelly.
We should know. We should say, yeah, we know the owners. We're big fans of Crooked Thumb. We've been there a few times as well.
We're actually drinking some of their beer right now.
Actually, yes, we are.
Mm-hmm. Ding! You can't see Josh smiling, but he just took a great sip of smiling. There's a twinkle.
Yep.
Maybe she'll capture that on the old camera there.
And so it's still, I mean, now it's going strong 4 years later.
Yeah, so we're into our fourth year now, and so it's kind of developed into... every week we meet, but the themes where I'm challenging people to write a new song are still bi-weekly, and on the opposite weeks, I get featured songwriters in there, and we do like a Nashville in the Round style.
So has your process changed? Because you were like, oh, I'm going to write some original music. Like, that was pre-songwriter night, but then come songwriter night, I mean, you were cranking stuff out. At least, you'd started, and actually the same friend that got me playing again is the same friend that was at Crooked Thumb. I was like, hey man, you got to come down here. They're doing this songwriters tonight. You should come check this out. And when I did, I mean, by the time I joined on, I don't know if that was week three or week four. I mean, it hadn't been going on too long.
No, it was very early on.
But I mean, you were cranking out really good stuff every week almost, or every other week.
Yeah, I was just finding the time, making the time, because it was brand new at that point, and it was like this like super, you know, new motivation to like not let myself down and not show up without a song, which tends to happen from time to time now. But no, the process really hasn't changed for me. It's finding some time and just picking up my guitar and noodling and finding some chord change that I've never used before, or finding some little way of playing something, and then trying to build a melody from there, and then tie whatever theme I'm working on, you know, I'll tie it in, you know, with that.
Mm-hmm. We're not going to let you off that easy. So you're listening to Neil Young growing up. What else are you listening to? Because you've turned me on to some people.
What am I listening to now?
No, or growing up, and then now, like, and then now.
Oh, I mean, I listened to a lot of the same stuff my folks did, but then, you know, I found, like, I was like hair bands for a while, you know, just.
Which is ironic.
Well, yeah. Yeah, good. That's very ironic.
Yes, it is.
But I had long hair growing up as a kid, if you can imagine that, and it was dark.
Interesting.
So, yeah. Now I get mistaken for like Shel Silverstein.
I totally see that.
I got my picture taken with a couple of guys in Texas because they were like, anybody ever tell you, you look like Shel Silverstein?
No, who's that? Yeah, never.
He's my favorite poet, man. So.
But your writing does not sound anything like a hair band.
No, definitely not.
I mean, when you're listening to music now, we had Jesse Terry on a couple weeks ago, and we asked him the question of like, you know, because for me, there's stuff that I listen to that I will never write anything like that, but I really enjoy listening to. Like, I'm not going to sit down and write a Foo Fighters tune.
Right.
You know? Like, I love the Foo Fighters.
Right.
But I will sit down and hear Andrew Duhon or John Fulbright, who's somebody you turned me on to, and be like, okay, like, I'm being imbibed with that.
Yeah.
You know? So do you listen to stuff for fun, and then is there stuff you're listening to when you want to have a sparklet?
I never really put anything on when I'm trying to get inspired. Really, usually when I listen to music, it's when I'm running. So usually I just pick something that is fitting my feel for that day.
So Jesse also had an interesting thing where he said he's got this, like, just books and books or like notebooks full of titles. Like, he's writing to a title sometimes.
Okay.
Are you somebody you start, I know you said you, right now you have a theme because you're assigning it to Songwriters Night, but
yeah.
Generally, are you sitting down, like, is it, you've got some kind of words in your head, or you've got something you're trying to stick something to, or are you a music first kind of guy?
Yeah, mostly music first kind of guy, but yeah, it just depends. Like, a lot of times when I'm, like, doing gardening and stuff like that, like pulling weeds or whatever, that's when I'll, like, think of a line and then just, like, all right. Let the weeds grow. I'm going inside to play guitar.
The garden epiphany.
Yeah, and then just try to work off of a phrase like that. It happens too. So,
And then one of the other things that's been really cool about the Songwriter Night, and Ed, I don't know if you had this with the jingle pitches, but you're not only getting a prompt, but you're also hearing everybody else's take on it, which is really cool. So it's sort of like, I don't know, book club's probably not the right word, but like everybody's approaching something different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to the same theme. So you're getting a bunch of other people's take. So you're getting inspiration without meaning to.
Yeah, you're getting homegrown inspiration. What, you know, friends that you can actually sit there and talk with, and like, wow, how did you ever think like to tie that into, you know? And it's just you have that in your arsenal for next time. Like,
right,
your brain might fire that way.
And you kind of hinted at this in what you were saying earlier, but it's the accountability also. Like, you know, you're going to be in the circle with other talented people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I got to bring my game.
You know?
Like, I got to bring something worthy.
So, and anybody else can just not show up, but I have to be there. So, like,
you get to
you're especially accountable.
I get to be there to witness these.
It's interesting, too. A lot of people, I shouldn't say a lot of people, there is a group of songwriters, and I think nobody's going to challenge me on this, that you're either writing for expression, you know, or they're writing to you. It's a catharsis or therapeutic. Like, mm-hmm. is that maybe playing's therapeutic? But are you saying stuff in your songs that's personal? Are you like, what are you writing about? Is it personal experience? Are you telling stories?
Definitely a little of both. You know,
because if you pick a topic you've got nothing relatable to, then
right, yeah. I would try to keep them pretty vague, but yeah.
Are you stacking the deck a little bit? Like, I started a song about weeds.
Yeah,
maybe next week.
Yeah, we've already got something to hop
No, I haven't really done that. They always the the songs always come after the theme. I never write that or have an idea for a song and then just be like, I'm going to make everybody else write a song about this too.
So did you go into the songwriter's night thinking, this is a great way to help this brewery that I care about and that I have a job at and I like working at, or like, I really want to be doing something in music?
Yeah, no, it was, I thought it was a great way to try to bring some people into this new space that I was going to be working at, but also create this accountability for myself and start to, transition into the artist and then recording artists and then, you know, actually feel like an actual songwriter when people are emailing you and telling you what the songs meant to them and everything like that. It's like, all right, this is why I want to be playing music.
So this songwriting group started in 2015 or
2016. Yeah, January.
And then your first official release, what year was that? 2017?
2017. Yeah. So, and the early summer.
So June, that's Mercy on the Strange. That's your first album of original material.
Yes, sir.
Which is crazy. So I remember approaching you a few times, and I think you might have been there one or two times, and you certainly played one of the featured songwriters nights with me at Crooked Thumb with Josh, but I had been hearing Josh for weeks, and I'm like, oh my God, where can I go hear this stuff? And you're like, I'm just making these up for this. Like, these weren't sitting there, you know? And so it started to get really frustrating because I'd want to hear these songs again, and I couldn't because you didn't have a recorder anywhere. But, like, did you have ambition to do that before I started forcing?
Well, I mean, I wanted to, but no, I certainly appreciate the gentle kick in the ass that you gave me to. Yes. And
it was selfish for me because I really wanted to listen to the music.
Well, we got there.
Yeah. So, yeah, so I was going to say, I mean, it occurs to me now looking back that was a pretty quick transition. Like, and it's funny, we were talking to Jesse where it's like, yeah, I started playing at 19. I was like, wait, what? You know, and same thing here. I again, just kind of assumed that you'd been playing and chasing and recording off and on for the last 2.5 decades.
Yeah. You know? Nope. So that's...
Well, screw you. Respect.
Well, no, it's kind of a cool thing because, you know, I didn't spend, you know, from the time I was 19 until the time I was 38 until I finally made a record trying to make it in the music industry. So I'm not jaded. You know, I'm starting it out just like, all right, well, now I'm going to try. Yeah. And so,
you know, the other thing about it is like my wife and I are like downsizing.
Mm-hmm.
So we recently, like I had this bin full of old notebooks and just reams of song lyrics, you know, from my 20s probably. And so I finally decided, why am I keeping this? Like, I'm going to get rid of it, all of it. So we lit a fire in the chimenea.
Yeah.
And we're like reading through these lyrics and I'm like, this is all crap.
Really?
So there's something to be said for like waiting until you have something, you know.
To say.
The bad pancake theory?
Yeah. You've gotten through the bad pancake phase and you're making decent, you know, hearty pancakes.
Right.
So.
Well, I think, is there something to be said too for like that gestation period, right? Where you're absorbing life. Your songs don't sound contrived. They don't sound forced. Like, you've seen things. You've experienced more. You've sort of gone through the insanity of being a teenager and, you know, your brain chemically firing at all different directions. And, but also, too, you've heard a lot of music, too. So you start to be able to, you know, hone maybe, like, you just have more to pull from when you start to express whatever it is you're trying to express.
Right.
So, yeah, maybe you've got it figured out. Maybe everyone should just stop until later.
Maybe. I don't know.
Well, you have a little more time to kind of like find your own voice too. Like, you're not trying to come up with something equivalent to what you've been listening to. You kind of eventually grow into your own voice.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's not just a mimic of something you're into at the moment.
So. But again, generally most people have to churn out a bunch of, I'll call it shit, to really like get, you know, really sharpen the writing pencil and playing too, because you know, you're a really good player. Like, you have a really good touch, your nuance. Like, so were you self-taught? I know you mentioned sitting in your
room. Yeah, no, definitely self-taught on guitar. I took a classical guitar class in college, and that just will screw you up.
Really?
Well, I mean, if you're used to playing a certain way, laid back on your couch hanging out, and then all of a sudden you've got to have your this foot up here and this foot down here and your thumb right here, and you're like, wait a minute.
Yeah,
this isn't playing guitar. Uh-huh. Yeah, so then that, I mean, it didn't really mess up my style. It just kind of was like, this has got to be easier for kids that have never played a guitar.
But then, Josh, you've also gone to, I remember you told me you were going to a songwriter's workshop. Did you ever end up going to that?
I'm trying to think which one that would have been.
Well, it was a guy that you really like. He's a guy you follow as a songwriter.
Oh, no, no. I haven't been to, it's Daryl Scott, I think, that you were talking about. I would love to do one of his writer's nights. I don't know when his next one coming up is, but I think he usually does it in Nashville, and it's a few days of spending time working in groups and working on even one-on-one with Daryl Scott and whoever he's working with there. So that would be really beneficial for me, I think.
And it's interesting how people, you know, will open you up to other stuff, because I have two of my best friends, husband and wife, are artists, and Jimmy and Laura. And Laura's been to a bunch of artist workshops. She's a visual artist and like benefits greatly from those things. I would have never thought about going to a songwriter's workshop. I'm somebody that kind of flows out of, and I'm not the greatest songwriter in the world, but I've never had a problem cranking something out when I sit down. And then, you know, I feel like somebody had mentioned that those things take place. There's these songwriter shops. I'm like, oh gosh, sort of the same idea you talked about with classical guitar. I'm like, I don't want to relearn something I've already sort of naturally learned and figured out and I'm absorbing on my own. But then going to songwriter's night, I've really benefited from that a lot. So it definitely reopened my mind to stuff like that. And then also, like I said, talking to other people in other parts of the art spectrum that do benefit a lot from that. So I'm sorry that if I scoffed at it.
No, yeah, no, it's everything that you can learn something from is worth doing, I think so.
Wise words.
Yeah.
Definitely wise words. So I approached you about making a record at some point. Because, again, I just really wanted to hear your music on a regular basis. Did you have, like, were you feeling ambitious about, like,
right.
You know, like, you had to know that you were writing good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I felt, once we were, you know, to the point where we were ready to go into the studio, I felt like I had a handful of really, you know, songs I could get behind and thought it was a really good start to put, you know. I waited that long for a reason. So I had these songs to put down and put some guys together and make it happen.
It was frustrating, actually, how easily they flowed out of you. I mean, there's maybe one or two off weeks in like that first year, but you were basically cranking out a record worthy song. Like, you know, if you wrote three songs, two of them were keepers.
I was trying. Yeah.
So a song like Homesick Butcher's Blues,
mm-hmm.
just kind of one, I would say one of your signature tunes.
Can
you listen back to that and think that, do you know which week, was there a prompt that initiated that song? Or
yeah,
was that just
the prompt for that one was,
Was it jobs or like labor or?
Yeah, it might have been something, it might have been work related. Yeah, I wish I could remember.
But it was one, I think it was the first night I came to, you'd been writing, you were like in the parking lot writing it.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, yeah.
And it's funny, I listened to that song and I think, is this like somebody Josh knows, like his uncle, or is this based on a friend of his or a family member? Or?
Yes, to all of those.
Okay.
So yeah, when I wrote that song, it's about working in a butcher shop, and I just pictured myself back in the break room, you know, and, There was a lot of the great cast of characters that worked in there. But I actually kind of based the characters in that song off of people I was working with at the time. A couple of guys I was working with at the Parks Department. And just the way that they talked and things they said, like, you know, you must be made of money, that kind of stuff. You know, if you took one less vacation a month, you wouldn't even need this job, you know, stuff like that. Like, I had a buddy, yeah, that would always harp on me because we were always going out of town. But if I had the time off, why not take it?
You want to play that one for us?
Yeah, I can do that.
Well, you must be made of money, boy. Why you even working here? I said the guy that ain't left Illinois for 15 some odd years. He said when my ex was with me, we used to drive down to the shore. And now I don't even go there. In my mind anymore. And he said, son, I'm here to tell you, if I was standing in your shoes, I'd be thinking less on traveling and more on paying dues. And we're all in this together, and it's hard to move it all. With our noses to the grindstone and our backs against the wall. And I've been working nights and weekends, saving up the cash to go see my family down in Florida and miss a week of cold and snow. And I spent both damn shotgun weekends skinning other people's deer and doing all I can to get there, just to find out I'm stuck here. And I've earned 10 days paid vacation that I thought was mine to use, but I guess I'll stay in Springfield with these homesick butchers blue. And we're all in this together, and it's hard to move it all. With our noses to the grindstone and our backs against the wall. Get by next week without you, and then they'll add up what you made since the old man's son took over. There ain't a man whose job here is safe. And we're all in this together, and it's hard to breathe at all. With our noses to the grindstone and our backs against the wall. Trade your time off in at Christmas. Like us corn-fed locals do. I trade your work boots in on flip-flops and lose them homesick butcher's blues.
Nice.
Very nice.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Appreciate it.
So, I mean, you talked a little bit about the lyrical content of Homesick.
Uh-huh.
But you're pulling from a lot of different places there, it sounds like.
Yeah. No, I am. I read a statistic I talk about a lot when I play that song. I read a statistic saying that Americans were afraid to use their vacation time more than a lot of other countries in fear they'd come back and find out that they were no longer needed there. Like, hey, we survived a week without this guy. We could probably get rid of him. So, you know, people would, like, urge you, like, I wouldn't take a vacation if I were you, you know. And that sentiment, you know, is something that's kind of scary. So I just thought, well, I could dive into that and tie some of my work experience of working in a butcher shop and just tie it in, like, you know, I worked there with my dad. So, my, you know, he liked that. He liked that song a lot. So he knew some of the characters, and he could really identify with that one.
And was the boss's son really a...
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
Well, if he's listening to this podcast, fuck you.
There you go. Well, my dad actually retired before the album came out, so...
Thank God.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he'd have been forced into retirement.
Yeah, he might have been. Yeah.
So did you actually work at the butcher shop?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, as a... on and off for a long time in my youth and early 20s. And yeah.
Was it an enjoyable job?
I mean, I can make the best out of anything. But, one of the most interesting things I remember doing there is during deer season, I'd bring the forklift around with a pallet on there. And I think I could fit 55-gallon drums on there. And they were all full of heads and hooves of deer. And I would pull those on there and then back up and go to the dumpster and then, you know, lift the pallet up over the top of the dumpster and climb out on top and dump barrels at a time of heads and hooves into the dumpster.
See, now I feel like we have to add a disclaimer at the top of this episode for, you know, vegetarians and, you know.
Yeah. Members of PETA.
Animal rights, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Specifically.
Yeah, maybe.
That sounds like that would definitely... numb a person in a way.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. I still eat meat.
Well,
yeah,
clearly not someone with a weak stomach.
What's that? Not with a weak stomach.
Did it make you question mortality?
No, not really.
Josh Riley, one of the deeper songwriters.
Yeah, no, it didn't. It was definitely a way to pay the bills, you know.
I don't know. I haven't worked that job before.
Well, you know, from the Midwest. That's and like fair. This. Yeah. Yeah, it was.
And now, a quick ditty about one of the companies supporting this podcast. Song Divers is proudly recorded in St. Petersburg, Florida. One of the reasons we love this area is due to how beautiful many of the homes and businesses are here. Well, many of those picturesque facades are due to the lush and tasteful work of Ryan's Green Design, one of the best landscaping and horticultural companies in the Southeast U.S. Their work can be seen from South Florida to South Carolina and on their social media channels. Whether it's updating your garden or a commercial retail center, getting a hold of Ryan's Green Design should be your first step. We can't wait to work with them on our next project, which we hope will be a new studio in our hometown. To see their work and get started on your next green space project, visit songdivers.com/green for a free quote. And now, back to the interview.
So Every Reason to Run, that's one of your newest songs, right?
Or? Yeah, no, I mean, I wrote it. It was out around the time of we wrapped up with Mercy on the Strange.
Okay.
It just right. didn't end up on there. But
slated for the next one.
Yes, slated for the next one. And We don't have any solid plans in place for that right now, but we're stacking up some songs, and I'm getting the itch, and more so than on the last album. The last album being my first studio experience, I really didn't know what to expect, and I didn't really have a clear vision for a lot of the songs going in as far as pre-production goes, and we just lucked out on the way it all came together.
I think it was kind of like, I was only there for a couple of nights, I think, and but I thought one cool thing was that your brother showed up,
yeah,
and sang on a couple, like one or two, like
almost everything, a bunch actually, of them? Okay. A lot of the high harmonies. Yeah, it was a thing. Like, we're going into the studio this day to do some harmonies. It'd be cool if you, or it's a shame you couldn't be there. And you know, and he's just like, well, what's the date? And I told him, and he was like.
So he's still, he lives up there in Illinois,
yeah,
right? Still,
yeah, he's in Illinois. So my older brother came down and sang on that. And I have a younger brother as well who's also involved in music and writes and sings.
We should say, too, of that record. So like Josh said, there wasn't a lot of pre-production worked out. But we had, you know, we had been planning to do our record. And the way Josh just sort of came about was, you know, we'd been like, all right, we're going to do another record this
when
year.
When you say our record, you mean record, Mercy McCoy.
Our band Mercy McCoy that Ed and I are in. And we were both traveling a lot. The band was traveling a lot. We hadn't finished writing. And my dad actually said, you know, you've been planning to do a record. You haven't spent the time on yours, but why don't you help Josh put his record out? Because you've got a label, you've got a band of players that are ready to play. And our drummer, Danny Gregory, who plays a lot with Mercy McCoy and has played in a lot of Ed's groups that we used on Mercy on the Strange. Yeah. And yeah, we ended up using a lot of our own Mercy McCoy musicians on that record. So it was still fun. And it was, you know, it wasn't the brutal process that I think recording probably can be for other people, depending on how you go about doing it. Because we had a lot of really great, you know, seasoned players that were used to playing and had been hearing the songs off and on because they're in our circles.
Right.
And I recently re-listened to it after having been away from it for a while. Mm-hmm. But when I knew you were coming in, I re-listened to it and I thought, you have just enough overdubs on that record. You know what I mean? It doesn't overpower your songs. So I think that helped too. And you had your friend Flycatcher come in and do some of the electric guitar work on there.
Yeah.
Which all sounded really tasty and great.
Yeah, he did almost all the electric guitar on there, I think.
Yeah.
Did you pick your own voice out of there?
You know what?
Yeah, Ed sang harmonies.
You know what? I was listening to or watching the video for Now I'm on the Spot and I can't.
Oh, what?
The pop song. It's really pretty.
You're Summer's Come and Gone?
Summer's Come and Gone.
Yeah.
Am I on that?
I think, yeah.
Midway through the
yeah,
video,
that's,
I'm thinking,
that's the
this,
one
is
you're
such
on.
This is such a pretty song. And I was listening to the harmonies and I'm thinking, I think I sang on this song.
Did. That was the one. I was at first second I was thinking it was Gibsonton, but now that you're that was it.
Yeah.
It was the the freedom of
Yes. That's a great song.
So how did it feel once you had the record like in your hand?
I was so relieved, man. I had a brief little tour, you know, lined up through the Midwest, house concerts, a couple of music festivals and things like that, and just to have it in hand, in time, ready to go, was amazing. It was like, all right, this is like major bucket list stuff. Like, I got a full length record of my stuff to share.
And since then too, so you mentioned at the top of the episode that, you know, you just played Dripping Springs late last year.
Yeah, late last year in October.
Tell us about that. What is that festival all about?
That festival is all about the song. It's really, really a cool thing. So Dripping Springs, where, as the locals call it, Drip, is outside of Austin. Austin's growing towards it, or it's growing towards Austin.
Austin, Texas, not Austin, yeah. Massachusetts.
Right. Right. So those two are growing towards each other, but it was a wonderful, wonderful community of people and a great list of songwriters from mainly Texas, Tennessee, and there was a handful of us from Florida.
There was quite a contingent representing Tampa Bay. Right?
Yeah, so we had a great group there, and it was just...
So how many artists and how many days?
I think there was maybe around 40 of us, 40 artists, and it was basically scheduled for 2 days, and then the Sunday is kind of a free-for-all, okay. And those that stuck around... we had a really good time that day, but Yeah, it was five different venues all along a little street. The weather wasn't perfect, but everyone was still out. And
so how many sets did you do, more than one set? Or did
yeah,
you
have I think I did two the first day and maybe four the next day. It was a great experience meeting some of these cool songwriters, and some of them I was just floored by, and like, oh my gosh, this guy's amazing. Love his music. Everyone's got to be listening to this. And then go to the Spotify, and there was like 11 followers, and I'm like, how is this a thing?
Wait, it is a thing, though. I mean, that's part of what this podcast is about, yeah, too, that there's so many talented people out there, you know, and,
yep,
you know, it's such a perfect storm of events that have to happen for the most talented people to get discovered, let alone people that aren't, you know?
Yeah.
Was there time at the festival to, in between performances and stuff, did they have any kind of opportunities to collaborate with other people, or kind of, it's not the kind of thing where they have like panels of people?
No. Okay. No, it's pretty loose.
It's just music.
Yeah. It's just music. And each stage had, you know, sound provided by Bose and someone there turning knobs, and you just basically filter in after the set before you and get comfortable with the people you're sitting around and go. And some of the rooms were like big, like dance hall rooms, and they would be full of people just chatting and going to town, going crazy. And then as soon as the music starts, boom.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Everyone's just listening to every word of everything, because that's what this festival's been about the whole time. So praying I get an invite back, because it was definitely one of the best networking things I've ever done. But just met some great people, and great music lovers there. So,
well, for the type of music that you are doing, also, I mean, that is the type of venue everybody dreams of being in, where everybody stops and listens to what you're saying, because it is, you know, heavier lyrical content,
right,
and it's a very, again, nuanced style of playing and style of music. You
right,
know?
Not a whole lot of grooves, and not a whole lot of repetition, and it's just, yeah. So if I can find a room where it's full of people and everyone's just listening, then that's definitely where I flourish.
Let me ask you, if you've have you done any house concerts? Have you looked into that?
Yeah,
that
realm? No, I have done. I've done quite a few of them. Right when the record came out, we lined up a string of them, and I did a little research into, you know, what makes a good one, because a lot of the people that were hosting them for me were first time people, so yeah. Which was cool.
Yeah,
because you don't have to have a lot of experience, you know, you just have to have
friends.
You just have to have 10 or 20 friends that'll pay $10 or $20 to sit down for, you know, a couple 45 minute sets, or however you work it out. And that's it. So
these were dates that you were able to put together on when you went on your little tour after the,
these were dates I was able to use social media to say, who would be interested in having this? And then a few people, you know, chime in, and then you just follow up with them and firm it up. And it worked out well.
So for some of your songs, like you said, I know some of them you're writing for the topic.
Mm-hmm.
But at a house concert where people are really focused, and it sounds like at a place like Dripping Springs, or, you know, a more intimate venue where people are really listening in, are some of your songs super autobiographical? And like, do you have anything that's heavy that in a venue like that you can get emotional about that are tough to play?
I try to not put anything out that I'm not gonna be able to just perform at any given time, you know. And I you gotta distance yourself and be cryptic to some degree, or else I don't know,
or somebody know you're singing about them.
Yeah, or just whatever. Yeah, you can be more, I guess, you can reach more people's thoughts and feelings if you keep it a little bit more general. So, but you got to be writing about a real sentiment, but just got to be careful with your approach, I suppose.
So as a listener, are you somebody that likes to know what songs are about? I mean, it's I should say too, you're a little biased because it's your craft also. But
yeah, but you'd be surprised how many times I hear a song that I've heard my entire life, and I'm like, oh Jesus, that's what he's talking about. So like a lot of it really is just what makes a song stick in your head, and everything is just the way that the melody fits in with the music and stuff like that. And you can hear the words and they all fit and they all right, that was great. And then one, you know, you can listen to a song a million times and finally, me personally, I may be just dense like that. And I'll be like, oh, wait, that's what that line's about. I never even realized they said that in this song. And then it kind of puts it all together.
Well, on the whole, I'd say I'm that type of writer also. I like to sort of paint in broad strokes and let people kind of fill in the color for themselves. But there's some songwriters that are very specific,
right,
you know, and are saying some very specific things.
Yeah.
It's funny. So Eddie Entrekin, who plays in Mercy McCoy and who I grew up playing with, he said a couple times, he's a great lover of music. And he's a few times he's commented to me, he's like, I don't want to know what these songs are about. Like, I want to enjoy what I think they're about, and mm-hmm. I just want to enjoy hearing them. I don't want to know that you wrote about something that's actually way less special or meaningful.
Exactly.
And I may be paraphrasing a little bit, but so it's funny how some people want to know and they want to dive in, and other people don't because maybe they hear it at the right time and it's the right lyric that they interpret the right way and it's just speaking to them at that time, you know?
Yeah.
And it can take the meaning away when you know, it's like, oh my God, you wrote this about someone you love, and you're like, it's actually about a cat.
Yeah. So, yeah, I like that. I like the broad strokes thing. Like, you see that a lot with, like, Tweety's writing and stuff like that. You're just like,
okay. You mean Jeff Tweety from Wilco?
Jeff, that's what I mean. Uh-huh. I was like, you know, I've never assassined down the avenue before, but he apparently has.
Yes, absolutely.
So, yeah, it's just like you just hear these phrases that people put together, and I like that. Not every song has to be have a beginning, middle, and end, and it's just where everybody knows exactly what's happening. You know, I like the ones that leaves a lot of things up to interpretation.
But you also too, and you know, and we'll have you play Every Reason I Run here in a minute,
because okay.
That's one of your newer ones that didn't make it onto the record. So hopefully on the next one here, but when they hear that, one of the lyrics they'll hear that I absolutely love is in the chorus, you say, loving her was like licking honey off a mile of barbed wire fence. And yeah. I just love that image. It's such a juxtaposition. Like, where did that come from? Did it just come out?
Yeah, that might have been one of those weed pulling things where I'm just like working around the house. And I was like, well, that's a borderline creepy metaphor.
Well, it's a song also about infidelity, right?
Yeah.
So
not autobiographical. That was one of the one of the songwriter nights.
Yeah, definitely. The cheating was a theme. You know, we were sticking to a lot of rootsy, you know, traditional kind of themes, and so
sinful themes.
Yeah, murder, so, and cheating, and stuff like that. So yeah, that was just kind of a look into a relationship, maybe where someone's feeling unnoticed and where it can go from there. So it's more of like it's a warning, like, hey, you better love your lover or else they're gonna find something better to do, I suppose.
I feel like but it's also a very relatable lyric too. I'm sure a lot of people can relate to something that's really, really sweet and good, but mm-hmm. also terrible at the same time.
Right.
You know, it speaks to like an unhealthy relationship.
Yeah.
Which I absolutely love that lyric. I'm looking forward to playing that one.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, would you mind playing that one for us now? You ready?
Sure.
All right.
Okay. There was a time when I tried to make you love me every day. But you dance around advances and step aside from chances in a honingly honest, deliberate type of way. And I felt unnoticed, I know you've known this all along. On, babe, it's like you've cashed in every ounce of passion and left me with no other choice but to go and do you wrong. I started mixing love and danger in search of something more in
didn't have to be this way, but you're every reason I run, every reason I'm in her arms today. And we're past the point now where I'd consider turning back. Oh, 'cause there's no way to unmake every little heartbreak. Oh, let's just roll the credits, babe, and fade to black. But I still remember when our love was something to behold. Oh, but now it seems you only long to leave me lonely. And what were you expecting when you turned so cold? I started mixing love and danger in search of something more intense. And loving her was licking honey off a mile of barbed wire fence. And you're every reason I run. It didn't have to be this way, but you're every reason I run, every reason I'm in her arms. And you're every reason I run. It didn't have to be this way, but you're every reason I run, every reason I'm in her arms today.
Thank you. That's a little bit lower than I normally play, so that actually felt good. Maybe it's the sitting.
Yes, well, this is a comfortable space.
This is.
You know, it's a therapy session as much as it is a, you know, a critical endeavor to look at songwriting, soul writing.
I feel like I'm on the couch, like, you know, like the patient, but.
You can recline if you want. You want to lay.
Let me put my feet up.
Because we're about to go into some real personal stuff now.
Uh-huh. Usually the...
like your prison time, for example.
Oh, yeah. The time I did in Joliet, yes.
You did go a little Johnny Cash on us, though, because one of the themes was, I believe, was criminals, right?
Yeah, that was the one. That was one of them.
And you wrote another one of my favorites for that, which is She Knows a Man Can Change.
Yeah.
Which was such a cool take. And is on your record was a cool take on the theme. Again, I think the song was like criminal or like crime.
I think it was criminal was the theme.
So a lot of us talked about, you know, all kinds of different stuff that most people would go to. And Josh wrote about the women that fall in love with prisoners. Like from afar, like seeing them in the paper.
Well, she clipped the headline, the read his name, and she keeps the letters that he writes. That they came. And she knows a man can change. Oh, they don't know you like I do, Ray. Let the daylight have you here to hold me at the end of every day. They keep you locked away. And Ray says, baby,
I watch a lot of prison TV. Like when I don't watch a lot of TV, but when I watch TV,
you're watching the Prison Channel.
Yeah, pretty much. When I do watch TV and I've got like it to myself, I'm like, all right, let's see what's happening in Brushy Mountain, and and so I just, you know, I'm interested. It's just a whole other world.
Is that where that came from, though? From being aware of that stuff through Prison TV?
Pretty much, yeah.
So that's not autobiographical.
No, I haven't done any
hard time. Some soft time.
Everybody does a little soft time. But it does come up a lot in my writing, just because, I don't know, maybe a prisoner will hear it someday and feel a little better about themselves for that day, because, I don't know, it's just, we tend to forget those guys and ladies.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And it's a whole... I've worked with people, or I've had people that worked in the prison system that have heard that song and be like, man, how do you know? You know, like I used to open mail or listen to calls, and that was my job. And it's always either I love you, by the way, where's my money, or I hate you, where's my money? Like, it's just all, yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah, it introduces a whole different aspect into writing a relationship song if you throw some concrete and barbed wire in there.
Would you say that there's a theme through a lot of your songs? Like, maybe the topics change, but are you focused around... I mean, it's a lot of people write about relationships. I'm often getting the critique of like, man, write about something, not a relationship. But I feel like that's so relatable to so many people.
I'd say that I've been asked that before, and I've put a little thought into it. And looking back on, most of the songs I've written, there is a lot of despair and things like that in them. But I try to at least get a little light of hope in there somewhere.
A ray of sunshine.
Yeah.
I don't know how prevalent it is, but when I was listening back, I was kind of noticing a few threads, and one of them was there's a strong sense of place in some of your songs.
Okay.
And along with that, sometimes it goes hand in hand with being stuck. Like the homesick butcher's blues, kind of stuck in your job, stuck in Illinois.
Yeah. I mean, I think that
maybe Memphis was another one where I felt like kind of like maybe another place. Like,
yeah, no.
You know,
I mean,
trying to find a place or maybe kind of being stuck in a place.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's an interesting point. And I think that it's a good thing to write about, because a lot of people get that way and feel that way.
Move on is another one.
Yeah.
Pick up and move on.
Yep.
You know,
that's true.
Well, and places can be very, like, you can tie a lot. It's things happening in that place. It becomes a, you know, symbolic, and you attach a lot to a place. So yeah, I mean, it's a lot of people that pick up and quite literally move on to somewhere else just to leave that all behind and, you know, try and move on from those things. So mm-hmm. Yeah, it is really interesting. You know, there's a lot of songwriters too. A lot of the stuff I listen to where, you know, you can hear them sing about a specific place, and same thing. It's very referential and very, very tied to a specific place. And you know, it's like you come back through that town, you see some of the signs, and it starts bringing back all these reminders and flags of stuff you're trying to forget, maybe.
Right. Yeah. No, that's a really good observation. And maybe I'll next time I put my pen to paper, I will try to avoid that.
No, I mean, it's worked out great for you so far.
Yeah. Yeah, no, but it's like, okay.
I don't mean it in the sense that you've, you know, mined that vein too often.
No, I understand that.
It's a good thing if you have persona or like a point of view.
Right. You're totally right. But yeah.
When you sort of, you know, this comes a little from knowing you, but from listening to the song so much too, it's almost like some of these places have a specific person or relationship tied to them. And a lot of them, you know, like, I feel like Lorena, probably not her actual name.
No. And not even a real situation. That was a song that was just like, I have no idea what's going on right now. I just picked up my guitar and started, and that's as close to a groove as I ever gotten writing
and
a song.
And the song sounded like Marina.
And so I just, yeah, and I went, and I was like a maybe 20, 24-year-old kid living in an apartment and just like wrote that song and then went down to this open mic down the street. I was living downtown, so I could just walk down the road with my guitar and plugged in and played it. And actually, I had a recording. I don't know. It's probably somewhere. Actually, I threw away every CD that I've ever owned one day. But so I probably don't have that. But a friend
what
of mine.
What do you mean you threw away every CD you ever owned?
Did God tell you to do that?
No, I think it was that lady on Netflix that tells you to get rid of stuff that you don't
okay.
know.
Is that why you're not wearing pants?
Yes, I did not have any pants that I loved enough to keep.
Nice tattoo on your
that brought you no joy.
Right. So no, that's that. I just one day was like, you know what? I'd never listened to this stuff, and it's just taking up space, and everything is
digital.
Everything is digital, and or I can find any of this online. So I just
except your original recording.
Yeah, except for
24-year-old you doing Lorena.
I bet you my mom's got a copy. I bet she does. That was just a fictitious kind of real broad general look on cheating.
What do you like? Who's your favorite artist right now? Like, who do you listen to when you're listening to stuff right now?
Oh, man. Lately, I have been listening to, let's see, just in the last couple of days, I've been listening to a lot of Elvis Costello.
Oh, yeah.
But as far as people that are maybe, who else am I listening to? I listen to a lot of John Moreland, John Fulbright, Isbell. We gotta listen when he says anything.
Do you listen to a lot of new music? Like, do you search for new music actively?
Not really. No. I mean, yeah. When I find it a lot, and I'll dive in on somebody. Yeah, or it finds me. But yeah, I'm pretty random when it comes to stuff like that. And I do a lot of running, so a lot of my music listening time is then. And, you know, I listened to Miles Davis the other day, listened to the whole Bitches Brew while on a pretty long run, 10-mile run. And that was awesome. They had my mind just firing in like 100 different directions. And I'm like, wow, sometimes you don't need to say anything, you know, like, and sometimes I'll just run with no music and really let my mind work. But that way was that was a different route altogether with the going through the city and looking at all the stuff.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I have a bunch of his vinyl right in the other room there.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny too, thinking about stuff like Miles Davis, but even the Beatles for me recently, you know, I grew up, my dad playing the Beatles all the time and, you know, seeing Ed play and all of our friends and family that playing Beatles stuff. And then, you know, now being older and, you know, you mentioned being a singer-songwriter, really starting in your 30s almost, like really getting serious about it. But like, I hear stuff so much differently now when I go in and listen and I'm like, my brain's just melting happily listening to, you know, Sgt. Pepper when they just re-released that. And it was like so incredible to go and hear that now, you know, years later after I've been hearing it almost literally my whole life.
Right.
I think there's something to doing something for a while, taking a step back from it and then coming back to it and, you know, looking at it, even with just a more seasoned lens or a more experienced lens, that you're able to appreciate things about it that you didn't notice before, or that you didn't know to notice before, you know, because maybe you learned something new or you realized somebody was playing a certain way. And so you start to notice that when other people are doing it the same way. And like your friend buys a new car and then you see that car everywhere, you know?
Right. Yeah, I think that's the cool thing about waiting so long to put out an album is
strategically. Waiting strategically.
Though. I did. I didn't want to do something recorded in my buddy's basement, which there's a lot of great stuff. But, you know, when I first was getting opportunities to do that, it wasn't the best equipment. And I didn't want to put all my, you know, heart and soul into something that was like, I'm going to print one of these on my mom's computer and then I'm going to draw, which there's something to be said for that. But I wanted to like have stacks of plastic wrap.
Tangible. You want something tangible.
Yeah.
Well, and you went to, we should say Zen Recording with the great Steve Connolly.
Yes.
So that was not a bad place to start.
No, that was a great place to start.
Yeah, you did it right. You had the privilege of us using a bunch of the resources we'd been using that we had, been very frustrated by years and years ago that we've now fine-tuned and flattened out. Plus, we had Steve. So, yeah, that was a fun experience.
That really was.
How about favorite gig you've ever played?
Oh, man. You know what? I really had a good time opening up for Anders Osborne at the Attic in Ybor City. Because I love his music. I've loved it for a long time. But then he was just super gracious, and we had a great time beforehand, sound checking and hanging out in the green room. And we actually we're just jamming back there. I actually got to help his guitar tech put his pickup back in because they were doing some switching around. So I was elbow deep in his guitar and we were jamming and ended up, he called me back up on stage during his set and jammed one of my songs with me. And then I got to jam on one of his with him. And
oh, that's so cool. That's so awesome.
It was pretty unprecedented. I was like, oh my gosh.
Well, and you recently played with John McCune.
Yep. Yeah.
Gritty Dirt Band as well.
Yeah, I did. I got to open for John down in right here in St. Pete.
Yeah.
At the Hideaway. And he had a great crowd and a great group of people playing with him that night. So
you just mentioned two local, just really great rooms that we're so fortunate to have here, the Hideaway in St. Petersburg and the Attic in Tampa. Like,
we are very, very fortunate to have them. And it's one of the, and we have WMNF. So that's like the trifecta of really cool, just to start, of aspects of living and playing in this area, you know. And you don't want to oversaturate and play too many shows in one area, but man, we have some really good,
got a lot of really good support. Spots you got a go. Good system here.
Yeah.
For sure. And I should say, you're playing the upcoming Gasparilla Music Fest, which is a really cool festival that takes place here in the Tampa Bay area.
Yes.
It's booked by Broken Mold, and they're a great group that put a lot of great stuff together here. But I mean, Everett Brothers.
Yeah, that's
Lucas Nelson.
Yeah.
A lot of big names on that. Gary Clark Jr. Yeah, let's not forget. Yeah.
No, that's great to, you know, like this is when I announce gigs like that, it's like when people from my hometown and my cousins and stuff start texting me like, "Dude, you're playing on the same, you know, stage as these guys or the same venue," and it's like, yeah. Little validation. Yeah,
feels good. No big deal. Yeah.
So
no, it's really exciting. So how about goals for the next record?
Goals for the next record would be to, yeah, just be having a lot more pre-production done. I'd like to do at least a handful of the songs live off the floor with musicians. I think that'd be fun just to work that way instead of piecing things together. I'd like to work with some different instrumentation, maybe, you know. I had violin or fiddle on one of the track, but I'd like maybe like a string section maybe on a couple of things. But as far as the next record, I want it to be better than the first, and I want it to reach further. I think that's kind of the goal that everybody has. I think that waiting and doing mine the way I did, basically to get the attention that I want to get out of the next one, I think you kind of have to have that basis that you got to have one in the books, and then, all right, coming back and you know
a catalog.
Yeah. And you know a little bit more about, you know, who to reach out to and when, try to get press on it before it comes out. And
well, let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, that's definitely probably something that's going to be interesting to people listening to this interview, is probably a lot of people at the same stage you're at that are great songwriters that have had a little bit of success. I'd say you've had a lot of success, but maybe they've had a little bit of success. But, you know, like, what specifically are things that you think you want to definitely do different, or your things like, oh, man, I really wished I'd done more of this, or things along that line?
Yeah, no, I just want to make sure that I'm happy with, like, there's, you know, a lot of songs on this one that on the first one that, yeah, I like the song, not, and I wasn't 100% in love with the way we recorded or whatever. Mm-hmm. The next one, I want to be a little more hands-on and know, I want to shape that sound before we ever even just, you know, we kind of built the sound piece by piece the last time, and we were all kind of seeing what it sounded like as it came together. I want to have a clearer vision on that coming in. And then, yeah, just focus on on maybe jumping on with an artist that's doing a substantial tour instead of just piecing together my own thing.
What another question for you? How about some opportunities you didn't take that you wish you had?
Well, when my brother had a club that he was running in Springfield called Andiamo, it's this little coffee shop, and we did an open mic and stuff up top, but then there was a room downstairs called Charlie's Club, and every once in a while he'd book a touring artist through there. And we had a guy by the name of Eric Taylor there, and he was he's a Texas songwriter. He was a contemporary with Towns and Steve Earle and all those guys. And so I was really excited about the show, and I had a wedding rehearsal dinner that night. So I ducked out of that just a little bit early and started heading down the stairs to go see this concert. And I don't hear anything. I don't hear anybody down there. And I'm like, what is going on here? So I come around the corner, and everyone in the crowd is just staring at him. And he's just like tuning his guitar or putting a capo on. And everyone is just waiting for him to do something. And I was like really impressed with the way that he just had this room. And ended up, he put on a great show, and we stuck around afterwards, and there was whiskey involved, and this guy named, I think his name was Ben, he had this great, big, awesome guitar vault in his house, and he went and, like, grabbed some of the real great humdingers and brought them down there, and we all sat around, a handful of us, just sharing music with this Texas songwriter and having a really good time. And towards the end of the night, he's like, all right, well, let's go, Josh. And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, we got a show in Ann Arbor or whatever he was heading off to next. You're coming with me. And I'm like, oh. I had this Midwest work ethic thing that I talked about a little before, where I had probably three jobs, and it was just logistically, like, I can't just go out of town right now. I would have to answer to all kinds of people. So I neglected to join him. And it was a couple years later, I was in Chicago, maybe even more than a couple years later, in Chicago to see Lyle Lovett at the Chicago Theater for my birthday.
So good.
Oh, it was so good. And he tells this story. Sounds strikingly similar to the one that I just told you guys, where how he was playing a show, or he met Eric Taylor one time, and they played some music together, and he hopped in Eric's truck and started doing some shows with them, and then he married
Julie Roberts.
Julie Roberts. Yeah.
Immediately
that,
after.
Yeah, that was how the timeline
went. Became Lyle Lovett.
Yeah, he became
Lyle Lovett first.
Yeah.
I guess he was probably always Lyle Lovett.
Yeah. But no, it, you know what I mean? It's just
the Julia thing. How long did that last?
It didn't last. It didn't last. I think that she's
longer than it lasted with me.
Ooh, yeah. She, I think she got famous off loving Lyle. You know?
Yeah, he's not talented.
He's got a whole lot more to claim, you know. Now,
says the musician. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Josh Riley, we appreciate you doing this with us, man. We love you. We love your music. Appreciate you doing this.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And thank you to Shay, too. Thanks for bringing her with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool, man. Well, we'll see you soon.
All right. Thanks, fellas.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Song Divers.
Thank you for supporting us and our sponsors and all the great independent music makers out there trying to make their way in the music business these days. The opinions expressed by our guests are their own. And songs we heard in this episode are Seven Shot Revolver, Homesick Butcher's Blues, Every Reason I Run, She Knows a Man Can Change, and Summer's Come and Gone, all written by Joshua Riley.
Thank you to Joshua Riley for coming by the studio. If you want to hear more of Josh, catch him on tour, or book him for house concerts and private events, visit joshuariley.com. That's Riley, R-E-I-L-L-Y. You can find Josh on iTunes and Spotify, and keep up with him on Facebook and Instagram.
Oh, the stars are low and bright at night, it seems, when July comes to town.
How do you think you did? think everything he said was complete bullshit.
Song Divers is a production of Ybor City Records and recorded in the historic Kenwood district of St. Petersburg, Florida.